You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 17th of November 2017 on Monocle 24. The Monocle Daily in association with UBS. Hello from Midori House in London and welcome to the Monocle Daily here on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller, coming up in the programme.
It's 18 months since the referendum. It's 10 years since people who wanted a referendum started agitating for one. Sometimes it doesn't seem like they thought all this through.
Ireland's Prime Minister points out the obvious. Somebody had to. Has anyone yet figured out how Northern Ireland can leave the EU while staying in the UK? Spoiler alert, no. Also ahead, we'll have the latest from Harare and analysis of what appears at the risk of tempting fate to be the end of Zimbabwe's overlong Robert Mugabe era. We'll have an extended discussion of the future of Kurdistan's independence aspirations after an independence referendum, which doesn't appear to have helped. Later in the show,
more and more people are testifying against mafia requests for protection money, and that's crucial because that's a revolutionary act. Protection money is the mafia's tax base.
We will reflect on the life of one of Italy's most feared gangsters. Plus, we'll plot your weekend in Toronto and review the Asian newspapers. All that coming up in the next 60 minutes on the Monocle Daily, live from London on Monocle 24. But first, a quick look at the day's other top stories. Cameroon's parliament building in Yaoundé has been partially destroyed by fire. The blaze, which began overnight, was extinguished before it reached the debating chamber, but it appears to have gutted the top four floors of the building's offices, which house, among much else, Cameroon's main opposition party. No cause of the fire has yet been identified, but Cameroon's communications minister, Itcha Choroma, said it appeared to be accidental. Argentina's navy has lost contact with one of its submarines, the ARA San Juan. A German-built TR-1700 boat has not been heard from for more than 48 hours. Its last known position was off the coast of Patagonia. It is believed to have suffered an electrical fault affecting the communication systems. The government of the UK has offered the use of aircraft deployed in the Falkland Islands to assist in the search. Turkey has withdrawn 40 soldiers from a NATO exercise in Norway following what appears to have been a bewilderingly tactless prank by a civilian contractor. Troops reporting for the exercise were presented with a mock enemy in the form of a picture of Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, the founder of modern Turkey. Norway's Defence Minister Frank Bakke-Jensen and NATO Secretary-General Jens Stoltenberg have both apologised. The US Navy has condemned the behaviour of one of its pilots who used vapour trails to draw an immense and somewhat puerile picture in the skies over Okanogan County in Washington State. The pilot of the Boeing EA-18G Growler skywrote two circular shapes underpinning a more elongated ellipse, amusing many onlookers, if not his superiors. Earlier this year, the pilot of a Royal Air Force Typhoon delighted users of flight tracking websites by sketching something similar in the skies over Lincolnshire. And welcome to tonight's Monocle Daily with me, Andrew Muller. Now, the Yahoos and Grandstanders who campaigned for Brexit in 2015 were akin to those dogs who chase cars. They enjoyed the pursuit and the drama as an end in itself and never assumed for a minute that they might actually get what they were after and have to learn to drive the thing. Little to no consideration was given during the campaign to the practical upshots of a Leave victory, least of all to Ireland, whose Prime Minister Leo Varadkar today staked a bold claim on the understatement of the century title by saying, "Sometimes it doesn't seem like they've thought all this through." I'm joined with more on this by Quentin Peel, Associate Fellow at Chatham House, former foreign editor at the Financial Times. Quentin, I know that there's a very long answer to this question, which could well take the rest of the night, if not the terms of our natural lives. But briefly, what is it in particular that the Irish don't think the Brexiteers thought through?
The fact that if the British leave the customs union and the single market of the European Union, there will have to be a very real border again between the north of Ireland and the south. And that could restart the whole violence and violent confrontation, it would upend the peace process.
I mean, I know that area of Ireland very well. I know the border region well, as I'm sure you do as well. It's very difficult to overstate how completely impossible such a proposition is.
Absolutely.
Any kind of hard border with watchtowers and fence posts and uniformed British or Irish guards.
Yes, it would be just inviting attack by extremists of any description, but probably by Republican hardliners who would say what we got with the peace process was at least the invisible border, and we can't have that back. And I think that's what really worries the Irish. And it never occurred. You're absolutely right in your introduction.
Speaking as somebody who followed the referendum campaign closely because we were covering it, I genuinely don't recall it being the question coming up.
It was really shameful. Neither side raised the question. I remember raising the question with the Secretary of State for Northern Ireland, Theresa Villiers, who's a hardline Brexiter, and she accused me of the worst sort of scaremongering.
Well, is that better than being accused of the best sort of scaremonger? But Leo Varadkar, the Irish Taoiseach, has said today, and this is quite cute of him, really, that he wants a written guarantee from the United Kingdom that there will be no hard border. Now, can the government of the United Kingdom, in all good conscience, issue such a guarantee in writing?
Well, they have been saying all along that they are just as determined to have no hard border as the Irish Republic of Ireland government, and indeed as the European Union. They're all on the record as saying that. So, on the face of it, they really shouldn't have a problem. But the trouble is they haven't come up with any practical proposals as to how you don't have a border if it is actually a border between two completely different customs areas where you have to check rules of origin, tariffs, everything about goods crossing it.
Well, this is the difficulty, isn't it? Saying you're determined that something is or isn't going to happen is very different from it actually happening. I mean, for quite a lot of my childhood, I was determined that I was going to bat number 5 for Australia. That didn't make it any more likely.
It's very touching, Andrew.
To go back to the original proposition, has anybody, as far as we know, actually come up with any idea at all that addresses both the requirement for some border and the requirement that there not be a border?
Well, both the Republic of Ireland and the European Union have stated that you could do one of two things. Either the United Kingdom does remain in the customs union and therefore there is no need to have a border, or north and south of Ireland form their own customs union, effectively under the EU regulations. But that would create a clear distinction between Northern Ireland and the rest of the United Kingdom. That is utterly unacceptable to the Democratic Unionist Party from Northern Ireland, who are the people holding Theresa May in office.
Is it therefore possible, because Leo Varadkar, the Irish Taoiseach, has said if he doesn't get this written guarantee, then he is not of a mind to allow any further negotiations about trade talks and so forth to continue. And obviously, one of the many problems that the UK has is that any single one of the other EU states can basically stick a fork in the spokes anytime they feel like it. Is it actually possible that the Irish border question might make Brexit, at least the sort of full-fat, hardcore orthodox Brexit, literally impossible?
Well, very difficult. And I think that's why Varadkar is doing this now. This is the moment of his maximum pressure. He can actually do something at this stage. If he lets this go through to the end deal and actually we start negotiating what is going to be the trading relationship in the future, he might not be able to get this sort of guarantee. So this is the moment, and that's why he's gone in heavy. It's very interesting because the previous Taoiseach, Enda Kenny, was much softer on the whole thing. Varadkar's clearly decided this is an existential question for the Republic of Ireland, because it's not just the peace process, it's also their most important economic relationship and their most important human relationship. I mean, the cross-border travel of huge numbers of people, not just between North and South, between the Republic and the United Kingdom, is actually still a very big part of the basic existence of Ireland.
How important are those other dimensions? Because while it's obviously right and overdue that the Irish border question is being discussed, if rather, later than one might have preferred, What other does Ireland yet appreciate what other effects Brexit may have on it? It is, as you point out, a hugely important economic relationship and all sorts of other relationships between the United Kingdom and Ireland. Is it possible that Brexit could actually end up, you know, detrimentally affecting Ireland as well?
Absolutely. And that is the issue. I mean, I spent a month there in the summer in the Republic, and every day there's as much news on Brexit and as much concern on Brexit as there is in the UK papers. I was talking to a German official the other day who said, "Get real. We are not that bothered about Brexit. There are only two countries that are really affected, and that's Britain and Ireland."
Quentin Peel from Chatham House, thanks as always for joining us. You're listening to The Daily on Monocle 24. You're listening to the Monocle Daily on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. Now, startling though this week's events in Zimbabwe have been, the apparent downfall of Robert Mugabe does adhere to the time-worn template of dictatorships. The tyrant appears immovable and indomitable right up to the moment of his demise, after which he appears suddenly frail, even absurd. Today, Mugabe made his first public appearance since being placed under house arrest by his own army on Wednesday, presenting degrees at Open University in Harare, including one to the wife of the general who detained him. Mugabe is apparently insisting that he is still president. Well, I'm joined now from Harare by Grace Mutandwa, the journalist and author, and here in the studio by Martin Plout, the fellow a fellow at the Institute of Commonwealth Studies. Grace, in Harare, I'll come to you first. What does Harare feel like tonight? I know it's late on a Friday night, but does it feel noticeably different than it did this time last Friday?
Yes, it's noticeably different because usually the city is buzzing with vendors and all sorts of people even throughout the night. But there have been diminished numbers of people vending on the streets. But there is some euphoria within the Zimbabwean population because tomorrow a march has been organized by the war veterans, which has been underwritten by the army for them to go and actually demonstrate. And I think this is aimed at convincing SADC and the AU that the people of Zimbabwe can sort out their own issues and they don't want any intervention. They want Mugabe to go. And one other thing that has happened is that the 10 provinces of ZANU-PF have actually now voted to get Mugabe to resign.
Just staying with you, Grace, that this march tomorrow you're talking about by the Zimbabwean war veterans, how significant is that? Because they have traditionally been among Mugabe's staunchest supporters.
It is very significant because they have been the bedrock of his support. They have been the ones who have kept him in power for so long. They have been his foot soldiers. So for them to turn around and actually say they want him gone, and for them to turn around and actually mobilize the masses and to say Mugabe must go is very significant. It's a huge thing.
I'll come to Martin Plout here in the studio. Most recent reports from Harare suggest that despite all the pressure on him from pretty much every angle, Mugabe still insists that he's the president of Zimbabwe. Does he actually have any meaningful options left to him?
Well, I think they are diminishing. As Grace was pointing out, you know, the support is falling away every hour that passes. But he still, you know, is the elected president of Zimbabwe, an election which was endorsed by the African Union, which was endorsed by the Southern African leaders through SADC, as Grace was pointing out. So, you know, the only way of getting to resign is for him to resign, or for ZANU-PF, his own party, as Grace was pointing out, to pass a motion, in a sense, recalling him, dismissing him, getting rid of him in some way. And even then, it is extremely difficult. As long as he digs his heels in, and anybody who watched what happened in 1979 with the Lancaster House talks here in London and saw how tough he could be, how ruthlessly tough, and how deep his ability is to actually hold out and say no. I mean, nobody should underestimate this man.
And well, on that subject, Martin, what did you make of today's somewhat curious spectacle of him distributing degrees at Open University? He did not look like a man whose heart was in it.
Well, yes, but I mean, I say just be careful of underestimating. Extremely shrewd, very clever. The thing that was interesting about it was there were only three cars. There was no great convoy. You know, the army, in a sense, was sort of saying, look, this is Mr. Small Man now. You know, they aren't really, they would like to see him gone. They really would like to see him gone. And more than that, so would the rest of Southern Africa, and so would the Chinese.
Grace, on that thought about, you know, we've talked about Mugabe's dwindling support to the extent that even the war veterans who, as you said, were the bedrock of his base have turned against him. Does he still have anywhere in Zimbabwe any support at all? Are there any pockets of society that would still support him?
There might be a few people.
I think we might have lost Grace in Harare. Martin, I'll ask you the same question. Does he have a constituency at this point?
Well, I mean, don't forget that, you know, he is a Shona, which is the largest ethnic group in Zimbabwe. But within that, he is a Zuzuru. And, you know, the man who's most likely to take over is Emmerson Mnangagwa, who is a Karanga. Now, there are differences. The Karanga believe they've been kept out of some of the spoils. Although one has to be absolutely honest, you know, Mr. Mnangagwa is one of the richest men in Zimbabwe. He is also a man who has a terrible reputation. He's up to his elbows in blood. And, I mean, it's worthwhile just reading out what the United States said about him in 2000. Mnangagwa is widely feared and despised throughout the country, could be an even more repressive leader if he turns out to be Mugabe's appointed one. That's what the United States said about him in a private telex in 2000. Has he changed his spots? Well, let's hope so.
I believe we have Grace back on the line in Harare. Grace, I know it's very, very early in the process of whatever is going on with Robert Mugabe, if this is at least the beginning of the end. But if this is the finish for him, what do you think is going to be the popular mood as regards what should happen to him? Would people be happy for him to just be packed off into retirement or sent into exile or even perhaps put on trial? What do you do with a 93-year-old Robert Mugabe?
I think one thing that has been really surprising is that people have been very sympathetic towards what they want done to Mugabe. They are all saying that he should just be allowed to go. If he has to leave the country, he should leave the country. They have been less sympathetic towards the guys around him, the people like Jonathan Moyo, the people like Xavier Kasukuere. So I'm sure they would be quite pleased with him just going away, although years ago people would have said they would have wanted to see him tried for, you know, the Matabele massacres and the people who were killed in 2008 during the elections.
Just to follow that up, though, Grace, do you think then that there might be, if people are reasonably philosophical about what becomes of Robert Mugabe, might there be, I guess, popular anger if it's perceived that whoever succeeds him is being plucked from around that or from that circle around him?
At this moment, I get the feeling that people have actually moved away from that because they are seeing this as a means to an end. They believe that it will be easier to remove whoever comes in after Robert Mugabe because they believe they could use the vote to actually move him and that they could use the constitution because the constitution will give him two 5-year terms. I think people are pretty optimistic that this is the only way out because the person that they want to get rid of right now is Mugabe.
And also just staying with you, Grace, while you were offline there, Martin was reminding us that, you know, his recently deposed vice president and I guess the potential next president of Zimbabwe is very much implicated in some of the worst of what Robert Mugabe did. Would he be acceptable to most Zimbabweans, do you think, as a president?
That's very clear on the minds of the people. But as I said, he's seen as a means to an end. And I think within the military itself, they are also coming up with an agreeable solution, which is why we hear that they are thinking of making him the president, and then Dubiso Dabengwa from ZAPU, vice president, Joyce Mujuru, vice president, and possibly getting Morgan Tsvangirai in as prime minister.
Grace Mutandwa in Harare, Martin Plaut here in the studio. Thank you both very much for joining us. You're listening to The Daily on Monocle 24.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
No one has more. No one knows more.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
Subscribe today to become part of the Monocle family. From product design to the best places to go, Monocle will bring a monthly dose of fresh ideas to your door. Being part of the family also comes with a 10% discount at the shop and online, as well as unlimited access to our online archive. In addition, you will enjoy priority access to selected product collaborations and receive exclusive offers and invitations around the world. Subscriptions start from £55. For more information, visit monocle.com/subscribe.
You're listening to The Daily with me, Andrew Muller. It may have been 2017's biggest story that wasn't. On September 25th, the people of the Kurdish region of Iraq voted in a referendum on independence and inevitably voted overwhelmingly in favour of the creation of a Kurdish state, a dream nurtured through decades, if not centuries, of frustration and betrayal. However, events following the vote appear to have made a sovereign Kurdistan less likely rather than more. Iraq seized back some Kurdish-held territory, and all of Kurdistan's putative neighbours reiterated their hostility to the idea. Well, to look at where Kurdistan goes from here, I spoke earlier to Khashrau Ajgai, who's the Director of Political Affairs and Media with the Kurdish Regional Government's UK representation, to Saeed Kamali Dekhan, who has reported from Tehran for The Guardian, and the activist and writer Dilar Dirik.
I think there needed to be more preparation, not only in terms of what the people should expect as an outcome, but also the government needed more international guarantees. They needed more backing from different institutions of the world system in order to go ahead with such a referendum vote. I mean, it showed the ability of Turkey, of Iraq and Iran to unite on the question of suppressing any gains or any wishes of the Kurds to self-govern themselves. And I think in that sense, this over-reliance on American backing or internal disputes within political parties, the KRG needed to have resolved its own issues democratically before going ahead. But however, it is not possible to say one can regret this referendum because the backlash that came from the Iraqi side after all was just completely disproportionate, especially after the Kurdish fight against ISIS.
And so looking at that regional reaction to it, I mean, from Turkey and Iran, their non-enthusiasm for an independent Kurdistan is long-standing policy, and I guess if you're looking at it from their self-interested point of view, vaguely understandable. But did Kurdistan misjudge the severity of response from Iraq itself?
I think it did. I mean, on the day of the referendum, there were demonstrations in the Iranian side, in Iran's Kurdistan province, for example, in support of the referendum. So there is huge support in Iran for that referendum among the Iranian Kurds. So that makes the authorities in Tehran very anxious. There is decades of tension between the authorities in Tehran and Iran's ethnic Kurds near the Iraqi border. You know, there is a history there. But we have to remember that Iran is in a difficult situation politically, geographically, because of other reasons as well. So that's the last thing probably they want. At the same time, Iran is a country of many ethnic groups. We have the Azeris in Iran. We have the Iranian Arabs. We have the... So Iran is worried that if something like that happens or encourages the Kurdish population in the Iranian side, what happens to the Azeris in northwest of Iran, for example. So you can see why Iran was worried about the ramifications. At the time, it is grappling with the, you know, with the consequences of having Donald Trump in Washington, who's decertified the landmark nuclear deal, for example, or at the time when Saudi Arabia now are trying to build alliances with the Sunni Arab states in the region, as well as Israel, very surprisingly, to counter Iranian influence in the region.
Khosrow, one of the other things that's changing now, aside from the fact that the territory that the KRG controls inside Iraq has become quite smaller and is now minus the important city of Kirkuk and the region around that, there is, of course, a change or going to be a change in leadership at the top. Do we yet understand what the future of the KRG's government looks like? And is it necessarily desirable if the next leader of the KRG is also called Barzani?
The problem is, I mean, some people have also mistranslated this, that President Barzani is grabbing the power and doesn't want to go. It wasn't about that. It was about the law of presidency. And if it was about the law which would consider the system of ruling in Kurdistan, whether it's presidential, whether it's parliamentarian, or both of them. So the parliament didn't reach to an agreement on that. And whenever the parliament reaches to an agreement on that case, then the system would be clear. And then we know that the president would be elected, or whether he would be chosen by the parliament. For us, doesn't matter if the next leader is Barzani or is not Barzani. Having Barzani there was not because Barzani wanted to be there. We had always fair elections, and when you get the majority of the votes, then as a party, as a political party, you have right to appoint your people on those major and high profiles.
Dilar, the idea of Kurdistan as an independent entity has mostly been thought about or talked about, especially since the referendum, within the framework of the KRG territory in Iraq. But of course, the Kurdish nation is spread far beyond that. And you mentioned earlier the contribution of the Kurdish Peshmergas of various stripe to the fight against Islamic State. In your view, has the Kurds' experience, not just in Iraq, but in Syria as well, over the last few years in particular, changed the idea or the expectation of what an independent Kurdistan would be like, not necessarily as a geographical entity, but in terms of its values and its politics?
I think we need to always remember that the borders that are currently shaping the region that we're talking about have been drawn by colonial diplomats. So in that sense, this insistence, especially coming from the United States regarding Iraq, to hold together a nation state, or like a state like Iraq, which is extremely divided and sectarian, which is a result of US policies in part, the influence of countries like Turkey and Iran on the politics of that country, and also including Kurdish political parties. The tragedy of the Kurds is that due to their division into four different nation states, is that the big governments have always been able to exploit them and use them against each other and abandon them whenever they didn't need them anymore. In Syria as well, the Kurds have been the most reliable forces on the ground to fight against ISIS. They have just recently liberated the capital of ISIS, which is Raqqa. So in that sense, I'm not saying that necessarily creating a new state in Syria, for example, or in Iraq would be the ultimate solution. But we need to recognize that these borders that were drawn and that were then later on taken up by national elites, which were like the Ba'ath parties in Iraq or Syria or the Turkish Republic, extremely racist and chauvinistic against populations within them, we cannot hold on to this model because it doesn't work. Instead, we need new forms of confederalism or federalisms that are actually working, that are actually strong, which protect minorities on the ground, which are genuinely democratic. And actually, we can see different kinds of projects happening in cities like Manbij, in Tabqa, in the Syrian parts, where the Kurdish government, like the Kurdish-led government in the north of Syria, has actually gone out of its way to ally with Arab, the Turkmen, the Christian groups in the region. I mean, the SDF, the Syrian Democratic Forces, are in fact an alliance of different peoples there. And only this kind of decentralized model, which is not holding on to one religion or one national identity. Only that kind of model can work. However, unfortunately, the same people who are involved in the international coalition against ISIS, for example, are holding on to this. And the Kurds, as historically has been the case, are the ones who suffer from this. They have been used against the fight against ISIS. And we might even see that the same that has happened in Iraqi Kurdistan recently, the Americans might do the same about the Kurds in Syria. So what are the guarantees that people have on the ground? Because the Kurds are a people without a state, without much formal recognition in international institutions. They don't even have a representation in the United Nations, for example. There's not much room for the Kurds to negotiate and bring their demands on the table. So this needs to change. If people want to make peace with a population that lives at the borders of four of the most important states in the region, they have to engage with the Kurds. It's no longer possible to exclude them from important international conferences like Geneva when it comes to Syria, or it's not possible that the Peshmerga forces that are, like, obviously they're part of the KRG, that they're just being bypassed after they have been the ones rescuing the cities where the Iraqi army has run away from.
Really, what happens next? If you in particular are thinking that an independent, sovereign Kurdistan is a self-evident good, and I think it's a proposition for which there is a great deal of international sympathy for all the reasons we've discussed, what is it that the KRG can or should do next to try and take another step towards that?
I mean, okay, before answering this question, I just wanted to add something about Iran, Turkey, but we forgot the international community's reaction, America, Britain, and most of the other powers in the world. I just would like to say that the Kurds are really disappointed, and the KRG and the Peshmerga are really disappointed of the reaction of the international community. Kurds feel that they have been betrayed by them, and there wasn't a clear vision, there wasn't a clear support. And the issue is, we are not asking America or Britain to come beside us totally and leave Iraq alone. Now, we want them to be neutral. We want them to be balancing between us and Baghdad. But unfortunately, in reality and on the ground, it's the other way around. America and Britain, until recently, they have been siding with Baghdad against KRG. But what we should do, I mean, this would probably add another point as well to what Dilla said. We should first to concentrate on the internal issues in Kurdistan, which is also important for us to face the turmoil and to face the new era in the area. At the same time, we need to reorganize ourselves, and then we need to be hopeful that what happened is not the end of the story. And Kurds, actually, in reality, Kurds have been like that always, you know, having big troubles, big issues, and then getting up on their feet again. And at the same time, being ready to go into a serious negotiations with Baghdad on at least solving the issues that have been there for a decade between both sides.
Dilar, I'll ask you, I guess, a similar question, but stood on its head slightly. There is a, as you'll be aware, a fairly cartoonish Western narrative of Kurds, especially now and especially due to the fight against Islamic State. And it's one that's fairly flattering to the Kurds. They are portrayed as broadly pro-Western, pro-democratic, loyal allies, great soldiers, and so on and so on. Is there something that narrative is missing? Is there something important in particular that the West is failing to understand and failing to grasp?
I think it doesn't really serve the Kurds to glamorize them if nobody is actually willing to support their political demands, which has been the case, for example, when a lot of journalists would go and interview women fighters, but they wouldn't actually ask these women, what do you want politically? And these women would say, well, we want to be on the negotiation table when it comes to the future of Syria. It doesn't serve anybody to repeat these tropes about the Kurds as being, I don't know, pro-Western, pro-democratic. Actually, these discourses are used by some of the enemies of the Kurds in the Middle East to portray them in this very, like you said, cartoonish way as satellites of imperialism. For example, in Syria, for example, specifically, this goes back less than 100 years, where the Kurds have been in their rightful demands for self-determination. They have been called collaborators of Western imperialism. And this was then used against them for policies of ethnic cleansing and so on and so forth. The Kurds have been while having been portrayed quite, let's say, sometimes very positively on the international field, in the region, they have often been portrayed, and this is still the case if you look at the media in these states that we're talking about, as these collaborators, these traitors, the ones that want to hold us back from our glorious national missions. So, in fact, these sorts of portrayals, they don't really serve anybody. Instead, they need to focus on the demands of the people on the ground. They need to lead to a recognition of the Kurds as being fundamental members of the societies where they live, that they need to have the right for self-determination, whatever that may look like. It doesn't have to be an independent state. It can be, in the case of Turkey, for example, people simply want their own right to govern their own regions, but not in this secessionist way, but as equal citizens of that country. So even that is not granted to them.
Saeed, to come back to you finally for, I guess, a wider perspective again, and trying to finish on a somewhat upbeat and optimistic note. We have, of course, this week seen a dreadful earthquake strike that region, which is not the thing I'm being optimistic and upbeat about, but we had an extraordinarily swift response from Turkey in terms of delivering assistance and aid. Kurdistan's Prime Minister Nekavan Barzani has thanked Turkey for their prompt response. Turkey's Prime Minister Binali Yildirim speaking in terms of brothers and sisters in Kurdistan. What stops that sort of cooperation occurring when there isn't a natural disaster?
It's extraordinary that the region is in turmoil. It's the most turbulent region in the world now. You know, the war happening in every corner in the Middle East, and now you know, have tensions between Saudi Arabia and Lebanon, for example, with the Lebanese Prime Minister being, you know, held hostage, some people say, some people don't know, in Riyadh. Now, there are praise for the Kurdish people, and as you mentioned, in Iran as well, in the region. I think it's a plight that a lot of people have sympathy with. I think not necessarily the Kurds, but also other people, because they are struck by this unity that exists between the Kurdish people in both three, four countries. But for an independent state to happen, I think we understand after this referendum that there needs to be more, you know, work to be done. It's not only you can't just rely on a vote to have a state. At a time when nationalism, you know, is high everywhere in the world, you have that in Catalonia, in Spain, for example. I know it's different in Kurdistan, but relying only on the vote seems to be short of giving you the power to have that independent state.
That was Kajra Ajgai with the Kurdistan Regional Government's UK representation, Saeed Kamali Degham from The Guardian, and the activist and writer Dilar Dirik. You are listening to The Daily on Monocle 24. Now, Italian media has been reporting all day that the notorious Sicilian mafia boss Salvatore Toto Riina has died. Riina, who was 87, was the former boss of the feared Cosa Nostra group. Well, earlier, Matt Alagaia spoke to John Dickey, Professor of Italian Studies at University College London and the author of Cosa Nostra, A History of the Sicilian Mafia.
Riina rose to absolute domination, unprecedented level of power and centralization of Cosa Nostra, the Sicilian mafia, in the 1980s. Unprecedented level of violence as well. And for that reason, he really changed the course of Sicilian mafia history and with it, Italian history.
And how did he do that? How did he centralize power? I mean, was it his doing that he made?
Yeah, essentially, in the late 1970s, the Sicilian mafia took charge of the heroin pipeline into the eastern United States. There were refineries there, big shipments coming in and going across the Atlantic. And Riina was a very important mafia boss, but he was excluded essentially from the profits of that trade because he didn't have the connections to Cosa Nostra in the United States that other bosses had. So he formed an alliance across the Sicilian mafia, essentially took control of the structure of Cosa Nostra, given that he was excluded from its commercial networks, if you like, and then essentially performed what was a kind of military coup d'etat within the Sicilian mafia to take control, become the boss of all bosses. Along the way, he created a lot of enemies, and he also attracted the attention of the state because with the rising violence came increasing police attention, and Riina responded with brutality. He killed anybody he got in his way, police, magistrates, judges, and so on. Eventually, however, this strategy backfired. He and his men, albeit in absentia, were sentenced to irrevocable long prison sentences by Giovanni Falcone, the heroic Sicilian investigating magistrate. And Riina, in desperation, responded by murdering Falcone. Many people remember in 1992 that both Falcone and his close colleague Paolo Borsellino were blown up in Palermo by Riina's men. Riina was captured shortly afterwards. And the Sicilian mafia has really been in decline ever since.
And just let's go back to that Falcone and Borsellino case. I mean, was that a sign? You said that was really a sign of him being in desperation. That was kind of after his prime then, was it?
His authority within Cosa Nostra at that point was still absolute. But nonetheless, this judicial defeat was a catastrophe. Falcone and Borsellino's investigations and the so-called maxi trial that resulted from them proved the existence of the Sicilian mafia for the first time, proved that the mafia was a structure and not just some loose ensemble of gangsters.
So before that, it had been, everyone just assumed that it was really kind of
legally it didn't exist.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And Riina had promised his people that Falcone and Borsellino would be disabled politically, effectively, from pursuing their investigations. That didn't turn out to be what happened. The police continued to ramp up their operations against Cosa Nostra. Riina responded first by murdering the politician, the ally of political ally of the mafia, a man called Salvo Lima, that he could easily blame for failing to protect the mafia from Falcone and Borsellino. He killed him in March 92. And then soon afterwards in May, he killed Falcone and then Borsellino. But I think it was a sign of weakness rather than of strength, albeit that these were astonishingly daring and terrifying and shocking attacks.
And what has happened to the Sicilian mafia since he's been in prison for the past 25, 30 years?
Well, to give you an example, when he was arrested in 93, early in 93, Riina was on the way to a meeting of the commission, the sort of governing body of Palermo, Cosa Nostra. The commission hasn't managed to meet since then because the police have been watching them. There have been two major attempts to gather the leaders together from which a new leader might have emerged, but the police were watching both times and arrested everybody. That weakness of Cosa Nostra, which has many other manifestations, I'm just illustrating one aspect of it, is essentially why Riina, albeit despite the fact that he was in prison, has been in prison under a very strict prison regime since 93, remained formally the boss of all bosses until the day he died.
Okay. And when you go to Palermo and Sicily, do you think there is still an influence of the mafia? I mean, I was in Palermo last year and I met someone from Addio Pizzo, which is a charity that's working to erode the mafia's influence. Is it still a force in Sicily? Obviously not to the same extent, but do you think it is still a force?
Yes, it is, but it's weaker than it's ever been in its 150-year history. Addio Pizzo, which you quite rightly mentioned, is one important symptom of that weakness, because Addio Pizzo does is creates an alliance between businesses that refuse to pay protection money to the mafia and consumers who want to patronise businesses that refuse to pay protection money. It creates a positive circle, and it works, and it's growing, and more people are testifying against mafia requests for protection money. And that's crucial, because that's a revolutionary act, because protection money is the mafia's tax base. You can think of the mafia as a kind of shadow state, and protection rackets are its tax base.
Could you say a little bit just about how history will remember Riina?
He could well go down as the man who destroyed the mafia.
That was Matt Alagaia speaking earlier to John Dickey, the author of Cosa Nostra, A History of the Sicilian Mafia, about the life of Toto Riina. Coming up, our review of the Asian newspapers. Do stay tuned.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage, built on the unique dedication of our people. We bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work, and we know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in weekly to The Bulletin with UBS for all the latest insights and opinions from UBS and experts from around the world.
It is time now to take a look at the Asian newspapers. We're joined once again by John Everard, former UK ambassador to North Korea, among myriad other postings. We start with North Korea, John, which is, well, it's rapidly running out of friends, such as it once had.
Well, that's right. And the latest loss to its dwindling panoply of friends is Singapore has said that it will now cut all trade links with North Korea. This follows the Philippines, it follows a few other countries, in fact. Singapore, the sixth largest export market for North Korea, which, don't get too excited, I mean, China controls 90-something percent of all North Korean trade.
It's a big drop-off to second place, is what you're saying.
It's a very big drop-off to second place, and an even bigger drop-off down to six. Nevertheless, symbolically, it's important. Important, too, because historically, Singapore has always been broadly sympathetic to North Korea, arguing for understanding, giving them a bit of space to sort themselves out. That changed a lot after the killing of Kim Jong-nam in the airport in Kuala Lumpur, which, of course, is not very far from Singapore.
It's not.
And which caused a lot of hostile comment in Singapore at the time. In banning all trade, Singapore is actually going further than the United Nations Security Council resolution requires. You don't have to ban all trade to comply. You only have to ban certain specified items. But Singapore has probably decided that trade as a whole was so insignificant to Singapore in any case, that it was just easier administratively to ban the whole lot rather than fiddle around with what you could trade and what you couldn't.
Singapore taking the view that this is a vast degree of hassle for very little upside.
Yes, that's right. It's a technique that they call in the banking industry redlining. You simply give up on an area, put a red line in it and say, just don't go there.
Well, moving along to the Khaleej Times, and I guess sticking with the theme of somewhat eccentric enterprises in international trade, this is a proper great ripping yarn, but an incredibly depressing story.
Yes, that's right. The illegal bird trade out of Indonesia, which everybody knows has been going on for some time. The Indonesian authorities have been trying very hard to stamp it out, but particularly where it involves endangered species, as it so often does. And it's come to prominence in today's papers because an Indonesian police raid has found 125 birds stuffed into drain pipes of all things, with the kind of wire meshes over the front of the pipes to stop them flying away. They were apparently going to be shipped off to the Philippines, where there is a parrot smuggling ring, and the police have arrested four people. The photographs are really very distressing. A lot of parrots, rather fine green yellow-billed parrots, Eclectra I think they are called, and 41 rare white cockatoos. There's only a few thousand white cockatoos left in existence, so 41 is a lot of them to be caught and shipped in conditions that don't suggest that all of them would survive the voyage.
Well, moving along to the ABC out of Australia, this is reporting a local angle on the increasing, I guess, descent of Cambodia into a fairly orthodox and unabashed one-party state. There's some people in Cambodia suggesting that perhaps Australia might lean on a couple of the levers available to it here.
Well, that's right. A general call to the international community. The trigger, of course, has been the suspension by the Supreme Court, right, tell a lie, the decision by the Supreme Court that the main opposition party in Cambodia should dissolve itself. The Korean National Rescue Party was doing very well in polls. It made significant gains in the local elections in June. It was all set for a real battle with Hun Sen, the Prime Minister, who, of course, has been in power now for 32 years in the elections in July next year. But it's been told to dissolve itself, so it won't be doing very much campaigning, will it?
Its leader, as this article notes, has also been in prison since September.
Yes, that's right.
Which does rather cramp one's style.
It does cramp one's style. A lot of the appealing to the international community is being done by his daughter, and the new leader also is saying he'll probably have to flee the country. In addition to inviting the party to dissolve itself, a lot of the senior party members, 105 I think it is of them, have been proscribed effectively, told they can't engage in politics for 5 years.
Is there likely to be any much, I guess, response to this call from the Cambodian opposition? Because I'm sure that Australia and other countries, all things considered, would prefer it if Cambodia was a, you know, functional, open, free democracy and so forth. But is it one of those things where that Australia and other countries, given a choice between, you know, the devil you know, are quite happy for stability at the expense of all other considerations?
I doubt it. I think up until now, although Hun Sen has been in power, as I say, for 32 years, there have been genuine elections. And I think that the loss of those elections will be very badly seen by the international community. The big problem is, of course, what you do. Up until fairly recently, the threat of losing Western aid and loans and so on has been a real constraining factor on Hun Sen. But now he's got lots of Chinese money to play with. And the Chinese haven't been whispering anything about human rights, let alone democracy, in his ears. In fact, probably quite the opposite. So he's been liberated and is able to stamp down where he likes.
Well, to go back to where we came in, which is North Korea, and this is a story reported here by Agence France-Presse, but reported around the world. It's a remarkable story, a very sad one. Somebody's actually succeeded in getting out of North Korea, which is not an easy thing to do, and indeed it hasn't been in this case. But I guess it's what we learn from the state of the person.
Well, that's right. This is the soldier who rushed across the DMZ at Panmunjom, which is where there's no actual barbed wire. Pursued by a hail of gunfire, 40 rounds fired at him by his former comrades, four of which hit him. So he's not in a great state. But when the South Korean doctors took him to hospital to treat him for his gunshot wounds, they found he was riddled with roundworm, with internal parasites of all kinds. They fished one worm out, 27 centimetres long, and one of the doctors has gone on television to say he'd never seen a case like this before, except in textbooks. If this is the general state of the North Korean army, then perhaps they're not quite the effective fighting force we thought they were.
But just finally on this, this must be a thing across North Korean society generally, general basic poor health of the people.
I mean, health is not as good as in the West, you're right. But roundworm, intestinal parasites in general, you can stop by fairly basic personal hygiene. But the problem is specifically in the North Korean military, where the conditions on military bases are often disgusting and you can't keep hygiene up. Ordinary civilian North Koreans are usually very careful about keeping clean and probably don't have these levels of infestation.
John Everard, thanks as always for joining us. You're listening to The Daily. And finally tonight, it being a Friday night on The Daily, we're going to do that thing where we fling a dart at a map of the world and invite the correspondent nearest to where it lands to tell us what's happening where they are this weekend. This introduction would be so much more effective if we had some sort of sound effect, you know, the sort of thwack of dart hitting reinforced corkboard. But we don't. You can imagine it. Anyway, the lucky bureau is Toronto, from where I am joined by Bureau Chief Thomas Lewis. Thomas, it's a weekend in Toronto. What are we doing?
It is, Andrew. We're doing lots, actually. It's going to be a fairly busy one. Not a time for relaxing as a weekend in Toronto. The weather's turned pretty aggressively over the past week or two. Winter is officially here. We've been kind of spoiled over the past few years that it's been a gradual ease in into the bitter cold months, but not this year. So plenty of indoor activities and a sprinkling of outdoor wintry ones too. We're going to start at, I think, one of the most interesting film festivals here in Toronto, Andrew. That takes place this weekend. Of course, Toronto is known for for TIFF, the Toronto International Film Festival, which takes place in September every year. But this is Cine Iran, and it's a few days of Iranian films being shown at the Royal Ontario Museum here in Toronto, which is one of the grandest museums here in the centre of the city. And it's been going for about 3 years now, I believe, and it's a really interesting array of contemporary films being made in Iran at the moment, with plenty of sort of sit-down interviews and talks given by the directors of some of the films involved as well. So it's a slightly smaller scale festival, but a very intimate one at that too, and a really sort of revealing one, I think. And, you know, in its third year, it seems to be really gaining a bit of steam, I think it's fair to say.
Why didn't an Iranian film festival settle on Toronto? I mean, I know there's large Iranian populations right across North America. Is there one in Toronto?
There is, yes, and there's a large population of pretty much most populations, I think, here in Toronto, is how Toronto likes to bill itself. So it isn't doesn't feel like an unusual thing at all to have film festivals dedicated to, you know, sort of various communities who settled here over the years. And I'd say, you know, the Iranian Film Festival, I think, maybe has a little bit more potency this year, given, I suppose, the kind of rhetoric we're seeing south of the border towards Iran at the moment, and Iran being covered in the Canadian press as much as it is elsewhere. And I think to be able to sort of, you know, put flesh on the bones to many of those stories and see sort of Iran's very rich cultural life kind of up close is something that, you know, Torontonians really lap up. And Toronto really, in many ways, it, very broadly speaking, is a festival city of sorts. There's always some kind of festival, be it music, film, the arts, dance, books, you know, you name it, basically. Pretty much every weekend, it feels like. So this is the latest chapter in the winter film offering of Toronto, that's Cine Iran, which takes place this weekend.
Okay, and what other cultural happenings are afoot?
Well, there is, well, we've been to the cinema, Andrew, so we're going to go to the theatre next.
Is there going to be a sword fight?
No, well, not that. Well, I don't know, actually. I haven't seen the play yet. But the play that I wanted to sort of hone in on, it's quite an interesting one. It's a musical play. It's been getting really good reviews here. It's been produced by one of Toronto's best, I think, putting it lightly, producing theatres, the Tarragon Theatre here in the city. It's called Mr. She and His Lover, and it's based, I think, in part on a true story of a French diplomat who sort of got lured in by a rather mysterious opera singer. I don't know the full true story or how much license the creators of this play have made, but it's been absolutely hailed for its performances. The two lead actors in this, who obviously sing and act largely in Mandarin, with live subtitles being projected above the proscenium of the stage, is really being, you know, quite looked at as one of the sort of finest sort of theatrical offerings that Toronto's produced in some time, I think. So I'm going to try and snag a ticket before it's over towards the end of the month, I believe.
Okay, and if one is going out in Toronto this weekend, and though it is still only November, I just want to be as clear about that as I possibly can be. It is literally still only November. Does one have to be resigned to some sort of festive gaiety?
I'm afraid, yes, you do, Andrew.
Yippee.
You know, if you're going outside this weekend, put your Santa hats on if you're in Toronto, because I'm wearing mine
right now, Thomas.
I was about you to
as,
whisper
as
like
always,
that in my mouth.
As always.
No, every day is Christmas for you, Andrew. There are two huge Christmas events kicking off the festive season in Toronto. In real terms, on Saturday, we're having the lights being turned on at the Yonge Dundas Square.
It's November.
I know, but still it's happening, Andrew, and it's going to be great. And then on Sunday, we are having the annual huge Santa Claus parade. So the Santa Clauses of Canada.
I cannot stress this sufficiently, Thomas. It's. I realise it's not personally your fault, but Canada, can you hear me? It's November.
Can Christmas ever come too early, Andrew? Maybe it can. But look, the Santa Clauses are there sort of donning their beards and combing them and brushing them and plumping them up in time for Sunday's grand parade.
This is like a big parade of like loads and loads of Santa Clauses.
I believe so. I've never been to one myself before, but I am hopefully going to sort of trek out into the bitter cold Sunday air and see it for myself. But yes, it is quite an anticipated thing. And you're right. I think it does feel, for someone, you know, who is a newcomer to Canada, that Christmas does start kind of early here. But honestly, the temperatures, you kind of need something to liven up your sort of the atmosphere around you, frankly. So my neighbours have all put the Christmas lights up already. And I won't lie, it's sort of quite a nice cheery sight when you're trudging through the bitter winds to get across the threshold. So, you know, maybe that's why. It's never too early to celebrate Christmas here, this year at least, I don't know.
Thomas's neighbours, if you're listening, it's November. Thomas Lewis, thank you for joining us. And that is it for today's edition of The Daily. The show was produced by Tom Hall. The researchers were Daphne Karnesis and Tasha Kleeman. Our studio manager was Claire Urban. You can hear the sessions at Midori House, The Stack and The Foreign Desk tomorrow morning, London time, or any time you like after that, on our website or on iTunes. The Daily returns on Monday at 2200 London. Until then, have a great weekend. I'm Andrew Muller. Thank you for listening.